Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with longtime Afghan observer Thomas Barfield, the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. He is in Kabul, where there is growing apprehension as the withdrawal of US and NATO troops begins that the Taliban will take over. We will discuss the possible scenarios that might follow and the regional players who could fill the vacuum. Then we will examine the power of Grover Norquist, who has 95% of Republican lawmakers signed on to his no-tax pledge, and when he even suggested that not extending the Bush tax cuts might not be a tax increase, he set off a firestorm, forcing a quick retraction. Michael Ettinger, who is Vice President for Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress, joins us. We'll try to find out why this obscure Washington power player, described as Liberace with a wife, is the den mother for so many young Republican activists and who his financial backers are. Then finally, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Joby Warwick joins us. He covers national security for The Washington Post and is the author of a new book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA. We'll look into the shocking story he has uncovered that led to one of the greatest disasters in the CIA's history. Joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies. He is the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History, and is talking to us from Kabul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thanks very much.
You travel regularly to Afghanistan several times a year, and you just arrived in Kabul where it's very late at night. What's your impression this time? Is there any changes?
Well, outwardly, there don't seem to be any changes. That is, physically, the city is the same, but psychologically, people are asking themselves, what is the impact of the beginning of withdrawal of foreign forces? And they're also very concerned about the meaning of the recent assassinations that have taken place.
And it would seem that these Taliban assassinations are quite strategic. My understanding is that the Taliban feel that God and time is on their side, that they don't have to negotiate. What's your sense? Is Karzai kidding himself and ISAF and the Americans that you can negotiate with the Taliban?
Well, certainly people are discussing negotiations, but it's not clear what the Taliban are interested in negotiations about. The Taliban would like to give the impression that certainly time is on their side, that they would eventually have foreign forces leave. But the lack of a very strong summer offensive in southern Afghanistan this year causes some Afghans to wonder, do they have that ability over the next 2 years as foreign forces withdraw, but certainly haven't left yet.
What is the role of India, given that India has made a substantial investment in Afghanistan, particularly in aid, and there are now discussions in New Delhi as to whether the Indians should fill the vacuum left by the Americans, that it's one thing for the United States to wash its hands of Afghanistan, but apparently India doesn't feel that they can do that, that if the Taliban were to take over, Afghanistan would become a kind of home for all of the radical groups that are in Pakistan now or in the border. This would have an adverse impact on Kashmir, and it would also have an adverse impact on Uzbekistan and the bordering former stands in terms of the Taliban spreading their radicalism and therefore impeding India's efforts to find a way to make a bridge between the stands and India in order to get the energy resources.
Well, certainly India has had to rethink its strategic position, because as long as the United States was heavily involved in Afghanistan, it could play the role of protector of Afghanistan. India now does have to ask the question, can Afghanistan survive without international, and is India willing to take the risk of the Taliban returning? Now that international forces are talking and beginning to do some withdrawing, you're seeing some heavy discussions in India, because they are the ones that have, in some ways, the most to lose from a Taliban takeover. And they have invested very heavily in Afghanistan. But it's certainly, to some extent, not a fight they want to be involved in. So they find themselves in a difficult position. On the other hand, they are not very keen to listen to Pakistan say that the United States guarantee that India will not have a role, that Afghanistan will remain sort of Pakistan's client state. And that concerns them, as would the West be willing to make a deal with Pakistan on that basis, which would be against their interests. So I think one of the reasons you're seeing so much more discussion about this in Delhi is they are looking to the future of the region because they leave here. They can't go home.
Thomas Barfield, again, who is in Kabul, Afghanistan, where it's late at night. He's the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History, travels there regularly. You were saying earlier that the man on the street, if you will, is realizing that things are changing, that the ISAF and the Americans are beginning to leave, and there's some apprehension about whether or not the Taliban will take over. What do you think is the fate of the former Northern Alliance? Would that be automatically reconstituted as a hedge against a Taliban takeover, and therefore you would go back to the status quo ante before the U.S. invasion after 9/11?
Well, certainly the fear of many Afghans is that possible future be returned to the civil war that destroyed the country. It's something that they certainly do not want to see. But a number of things have changed over the past 10 years, and one of the things that has been changing is the rapid increase in size and training of the Afghan National Army, which to some extent is more dominated by non-Pashtuns than Pashtuns. So it's not a question of the place falling apart. We almost always focus on the Karzai regime, but there are other institutions. There's other ways that this game could play itself out. So it's not altogether clear that you would go back to a situation where regions of the country would want to fight it out. If the non-Pashtuns see that their interests are potentially being harmed, they may attempt to preempt that if they feel the Karzai government is too weak. The Karzai government has sort of less and less credibility, but people also are wondering about 2014 as a question of that's the year the Karzai is supposed to step down. And one of the biggest questions here is he going to step down or will there be a post-Karzai era? If there's a post-Karzai era, then you could get discussions now on what that form could take, which might be a very different way of structuring power than what we see today.
But Thomas Barfield, nobody seems to have much confidence in the Afghan National Army or the Afghan National Police. Certainly, I don't think anybody thinks they're up to the task of coping with the Taliban. I don't understand why, after all this money and time, they keep saying that one of these days this army is going to be ready, but it never is. And just the other day in Kandahar, when the British turned over, a couple of days before the British turned over an area, the Afghan National Police were all murdered by the Taliban at a checkpoint. Frankly, there's not much confidence in them. What's your sense there being on the ground?
Well, you have to make a big distinction between the Afghan National Police, of which nobody has any confidence in, and the Afghan National Army, which people do have some kind of confidence in. But to some extent, there's also a difference between can they keep order and stability as international forces withdraw, as opposed to, are they large enough to prevent the Taliban from taking over the government? That's two entirely different questions. The Taliban are not so strong that they can see themselves as sweeping into Kabul. And that's one of their concerns, that they're strong in certain areas, but not strong enough to take on the government militarily. And this is one of the things that brings about the uncertainty in Afghanistan on sort of all sides, because all sides sort of put out the best picture of how they want to be seen. But in reality, nobody's sure of what strength either the Taliban has, the Afghan National Army has, and what kind of government Afghanistan might have if Karzai goes, because we focus almost entirely on the Karzai government with him as the personal leader. And yet, if he's supposed to be out in 2014, the situation could be quite different. It could also be quite different because his brother was assassinated in Kandahar, and his brother was one of the major power holders in the south. It's unclear whether the family can hold together the power base they had in the south before his death.
And Thomas Barfield, wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that Pakistan, who have played a somewhat duplicitous role throughout this whole situation vis-a-vis the United States, and they are, I think, fairly clearly supporting the Haqqani network and sheltering Mullah Omar in Quetta, the so-called Quetta Shura. Wouldn't it be therefore likely that if the Taliban were to make their move to take over Afghanistan, that Pakistan, its covert support for them now would become overt?
I don't think so, because if it was overt, then that would bring down the United States and a number of their allies right on top of them. They cannot really afford, and they never did, even when they supported the Taliban in the 1990s, ever become overt about it. The other difficulty on that is the United States already seems to be planning for this eventuality by reducing the amount of supplies that come through Pakistan and bringing more through northern Afghanistan. And one of the dilemmas for Pakistan, as the number of U.S. troops decreases in Afghanistan and the supplies begin coming more from the northern part of the country through Russia, through Central Asia, the less Pakistan has in way of leverage over the United States, at which point the United States could simply work on a preserve Afghanistan policy of making sure there's enough support that Pakistan would not be able to take over Afghanistan, even in the absence of American troops. Remember, when the Soviets left Afghanistan, they left a regime that the Pakistanis were unable to overthrow, and it outlasted the Soviet Union. There's sort of precedent for this, and the Pakistanis certainly have to worry that Afghanistan could reform itself, actually stymie the efforts that they have to bring back the Taliban.
Well, the Najibullah regime that you refer to, I think it lasted 3 years after the Soviet withdrawal, did it not?
Yes, but it did not collapse until after the Soviet Union collapsed. Once the Soviet Union collapsed, there was no more weapons and no more money coming, at which point it essentially dissolved. Nobody believes that that type of situation in terms of the United States, that the United States would suddenly dissolve and there would be a vacuum in this part of the world. So the United States could, even if it left, supply money and weapons pretty much indefinitely. And if it doesn't have to bring them through Pakistan, that reduces Pakistan's leverage in terms of its negotiating position with the United States.
Well, Thomas Barfield, obviously, just going back to our earlier conversation about India and how there's more and more talk in New Delhi about whether or not India should step in to fill the strategic vacuum here and perhaps even train up the Afghan army, surely that would draw the Pakistanis in with more overt support for the Taliban, wouldn't it?
It might, but that would be a pyrrhic victory for Pakistan and the Taliban to have that kind of fight with India, because their whole strategy is in terms of getting the West to leave, to create a vacuum so that they could take over in the wake of foreign withdrawal. If India gets involved, it's likely never to withdraw. That is the best they could hope for, is a stalemate. And I think that is one of the things that Pakistan greatly fears. It's so paranoid about India. India lives in the neighborhood, and if it decides that Afghanistan is in its strategic interest, and it turns out that China wants to do investment in Afghanistan, so it doesn't want to see trouble there either, Pakistan would be on its own. And without American money, it's not clear how is Pakistan going to finance a war against Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a place that requires outside resources to fight wars in. It's a poor country. And at the moment, we sort of pay Pakistan to help pay for the insurgency. So at some point, that process needs to be short-circuited.
One would think, though, given India's concern that they would like to make energy deals with the stands and transport energy across Afghanistan and presumably across Pakistan into India or down to some kind of port somewhere and maybe work with the Iranians. It's difficult to know how these pipeline politics work. But the long and the short of it is, you would think that India and the Soviet Union, or the former Russia, I should say, formerly presiding over the stands and still having tremendous influence there, that India and Russia would be pretty much on the same page here, wouldn't they? They would not want a Taliban regime. And surely the Stans don't want more Islamic influence, and they'd like to sell their gas to this huge emerging market, wouldn't they?
They certainly would. And Pakistan is desperately in need of an energy supply as well. So, you know, it's a bit of how much adventurism does Pakistan want to engage in Afghanistan to the extent that it forecloses opportunities to directly help Pakistan itself economically. You're correct. If you look at the region, the only country that really at the moment wants to see an unstable Afghanistan is Pakistan. The Iranians don't want to see a return of the Taliban. The Stans don't want to see it, and Russia doesn't want to see it, and India doesn't want to see it. So when you begin to, you know, to look at it that way, you begin to see that Pakistan is quite isolated in some ways, and yet doesn't really have the resources in the long term to carry this off, because they are so dependent upon outside aid to make their own military and army work. And the question is, if it, not just so much Russia and India, which, you know, had old alliances during the Cold War, but if the United States and India decide that there's more al-Qaeda in Pakistan than there is in Afghanistan, and decide on a contained Pakistan policy, of which a stable Afghanistan becomes a part, the whole arrangement of how we're talking about security and regional alliances in this region could change, and change rather rapidly.
Well, it's still a persistent question about how much Pakistan, the government, controls the country. You know, there's, notwithstanding the old joke that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. The recent attack in Mumbai suggests that you've got this wild card element that can always be a spoiler.
There's certainly all these spoilers, but if you look at it, does Pakistan have the tax revenue in a country as highly populated and as poor as Pakistan to finance this international foreign policy? One of the postmortems of the Soviet Union was that the range of Soviet ambitions and the ability of the economy to make it work were out of sync. We certainly asked that question of ourselves in terms of the number of foreign wars the United States has been involved in. When you look at it, Pakistan itself is not one of the growing Asian powers like India or China, and its military is the most important institution there. But the question is, looking down the line, can they maintain the policies that they're doing in the long term, which I would argue are actually more potentially destructive for Pakistan than anyone else? The policies of supporting these various insurgents along the border are quite dangerous to Pakistan, because these very people would probably rather take Islamabad than they would Kabul.
Well, I don't know whether you saw that grim video of the 16 Pakistani policemen being murdered by the Pakistan Taliban on the border there. It was pretty hideous. It certainly brings that into stark relief.
Yes, and most governments, when they would think about this, they would do this as a calculation. Have they created a monster that they really can't control? And you can plot a little bit too far in terms of, you think you're bringing about one result, but the tools that you're using to do it, in fact, are more dangerous to you. And certainly the Taliban ideology has much more resonance in Pakistan than it does in Afghanistan. The Afghans saw the Taliban. They were ruled by the Taliban. There's not a huge amount of support for them ideologically, but they've gained much more support in Pakistan, and it's been growing much more in Pakistan than it has been in Afghanistan. Also, our concern about al-Qaeda and where they are, it's true there are very few left in Afghanistan, because they've all decamped to Pakistan. And so we really haven't, as the United States, asked ourselves, you know, what's the policy that we need to think of in the long term that brings stability to the region? And to some extent, talk to Pakistan seriously about, by stability, we mean not just stability for Afghanistan, but stability for Pakistan. And so many of Pakistan's policies, at least seems to me, run against its own interest. And that's where I think a really serious discussion about the implications of Pakistan's policy for its own self, not just, you know, for the region, needs to be done. It is not fruitful to beat the old anti-India drum forever. And I think that's what we seem to hear. That's where the money that the United States gives Pakistan goes. They're concerned about India. But I think in the long term, India is much more interested in stability in the region, not in, in the destabilization of the region.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, and he's the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. He spoke to us from Kabul in Afghanistan, where he visits regularly every year. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Grover, you keep trying to sell me things that I cannot use. For instance, I remember the time you sold me the earmuffs, and I do not have ears.
And still no ears, huh?
Right. And then the time you sold me a nose warmer, and I don't have a nose.
Oh, I see.
And then there was a time you sold me a toothbrush. And Grover, I have no teeth. No teeth. Ah.
Close your mouth, please.
Yes.
Aha! But you do have eyes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Michael Ettinger, who is Vice President for Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress. Prior to joining the center, he spent 6 years at the Economic Policy Institute directing the Economic Analysis and Research Network. And before that, he was Tax Policy Director for Citizens for Tax Justice and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Ettinger.
Nice to be with you.
Tell me, why is it that Grover Norquist has so much influence and so much power in Washington? He's already got, I think, about 90% of the Republicans to sign his anti-tax pledge. He's got 236 House members and 41 senators. And the very fact that he even suggested, almost like a medieval king, that perhaps we won't consider ending tax breaks, raising taxes, which, of course, has apparently turned Washington on its head. So what's going on?
Well, you know, I mean, the reason he's so influential is partly he's just been around for a long, long time and has been operating in Republican circles and, importantly, in Republican donor circles for a very long time. So he's very influential. Elected leaders, politicians pay him a lot of heed because he can bring down the wrath of donors, and he's very influential in who gets supported and who doesn't in elections. So that's obviously a very important to them.
So, Michael Ettinger, tell me then, who are his donors? Because clearly that's where his power base is.
Well, you know, that information he doesn't disclose. But, you know, I think if you think of the usual cast of characters on the right, you're not going to be far off. So, you know, he certainly has a lot of influence and has seen hobnobbing with you know, Kochs and all the other players on the right.
So then his agenda is their agenda. The idea that his main job is to make sure that businesses don't get taxed or wealthy individuals, is that what it comes down to?
Yeah, and, you know, I think that, I mean, in fairness to him, I do think that he's very sincere about wanting taxes to be as low as possible. I don't think he's been bought. I think he's very sincere, but he's put himself in a position to be very influential to push his agenda.
How intellectually flexible is this man? I believe he had a bit of a tiff with Chris Matthews, who asked him a simple question. Well, maybe not the same question, but a question I would ask him is, don't we have a revenue crisis? Isn't that our problem? We don't have a deficit crisis so much as a revenue crisis, surely. And how do you get revenues if you won't raise taxes?
He doesn't care. He doesn't care what the cause of the deficit is. He's anti-tax to his core, and that's his agenda. So, you know, if there's signs of him blinking or deviating from that, it's just a tactic to somehow live to fight another day. I think one of the more interesting things that's happened recently is that, you know, there are Republicans who recognize that even though they're not likely to embrace taxation as the answer to the deficit problem, they recognize that taxes are going to have to be part of the solution. And I think what Grover's doing is giving himself some wiggle room so that if a lot of Republicans end up voting for something that includes a tax increase, he doesn't lose face. It's not like, you know, they win against Grover. So I think that's some of the reason why he's probably kind of giving little signals that, well, it wouldn't necessarily be a violation of the pledge if this or that was done. He's setting himself up to save face if he needs to.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Ettinger, who is Vice President for Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress. So why is it then, it would seem that Grover Norquist has had such an influence that he's been able to shape the public debate about taxes? And it would seem to me that one would wish that somebody could point out the obvious. First of all, in other developed democracies where you have full health care and 6 weeks vacation and a huge safety net, and in fact, that as we speak, the most powerful economy in the world is the German economy, where German people have all of these benefits from their government. The understanding in most other democracies is you pay your taxes and you get your government services. And we pay less taxes than most countries, but we get the lowest government services of all. And the very few government services we get, the Medicare, Medicaid, the Grover Norquists and their backers of the world, they want to eliminate them. So the question then should be in the debate, surely, the issue is not how much we're taxed, but what we get back for our taxes.
Absolutely. And I think one of the byproducts of the deficit conversation maturing is that we're starting to get to that conversation. So we've seen what deficit reduction without tax increases looks like. The House passed their budget resolution, and it means ending Medicare as we know it. It means massive, you know, cuts to funding for education, all sorts of investments that people recognize are important. And that's going to sharpen the debate. What we've seen to this point has been just hand-waving that, oh, we can cut the deficit without raising taxes and not hurt anybody. And it's becoming evident that isn't true. So I think that's actually a lot of progress.
But surely you can also, Michael Ettinger, just look at the example of Greece and others. When you introduce austerity, which is really what at the heart of both what the president's offered up in his $4 trillion deal, at least as much as we know about it, and the $3.7 trillion deal that the so-called Gang of Six senators are offering up, it's like, you know, what, 75-80% austerity. And we know that austerity kills economic recovery. It is just a fact. And that's a part of again, that seems to be missing from the debate. Do you think the mainstream press are letting us down? Why do the deficit hawks have the soapbox?
One thing to keep in mind is that these deals are all, when you hear $4 trillion or these big numbers, they're over 10 years. And what is really important to keep an eye on is when those 10, you know, however many trillion dollars of cuts happen, because I'm sure that the president is pushing for them to be later in the period because of exactly what you're describing. We don't want to cut off the recovery of the economy.
In terms of delaying things to later, my understanding is that the biggest driver of the deficit are medical costs, most of them in the private sector. And that my understanding is that what is referred to derisively as Obamacare, the healthcare reform bill, in fact, addresses this. So how is that going to factor in? Will there be tangible benefits from that bill as it comes into play that will be able to deal with the out-of-control healthcare costs?
Well, healthcare costs are a problem in the next 10 years, but it's really after that, outside this immediate period, where they become the overriding cause of our deficit problems. The Bush tax cuts are a huge cause of our deficit problems in the next 10 years. So, you know, I think revenue is clearly needs to be part of the picture. We also, the country spends more than the rest of the world combined on defense spending. Adjusted for inflation, we spend now the same amount or more than we spent at the peak of the Cold War, and we're projected to do so even after we get out of Afghanistan and Iraq. which will hopefully happen. And so there are things in the budget that can be cut, and there are multiple things driving the deficits. But you're right, the Affordable Care Act that was passed, one of its major accomplishments was that it did contribute to deficit reduction in this 10-year window. And it's very important that that be implemented and implemented aggressively. And efforts to stop it and pull back on it are really counterproductive from that standpoint. If they do that, what you're going to see is health care cuts that are less well thought out, just basically brute force cuts that will do harm to people's health care as opposed to the Affordable Care Act, which is a more comprehensive, well thought out approach.
So, Michael Ettlinger, in terms of economics 101, my understanding is that we wouldn't be having a discussion about the deficit and the debt if employment were back at normal and if the economy had the sort of demand that it normally has. But the problem we have now is no demand and high unemployment. That's basically the problem, isn't it? And if you got rid of the big drivers that dug us into the hole, the two Bush wars and the Bush tax cuts, again, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Well, in terms of the immediate deficits, that's true. In terms of the longer-term deficits, we certainly are not going to be able to deal with those deficits if we have a weak economy. That's absolutely true. But even if we get back to normal levels of growth and normal levels of demand and unemployment 5-6 years from now, we'll have a deficit levels that are unsustainable unless we do something. So there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. We do need to get the economy back on track, or there's really no way to deal with these deficits. But it's going to take more in the years to come.
But my understanding is that, I mean, the way I see it, Michael Ettlinger, is that we have an economic hostage crisis in Washington because the Republicans have decided to use a mechanism that's been around forever, that's never generated any controversy until they seized upon it, to use it as blackmail and leverage to either say, we're going to wreck the economy unless you make concessions to us. And the president and the Democrats are in a dilemma because they can't call their bluff and take the chance risk of it. And no matter what happens, it looks as if the Democrats are going to inherit already weak economy that could be damaged even further. Is that, a fair analysis of what's going on?
That's a real risk. Absolutely. I think that is a good statement of the situation. I would say that the only thing that the question is whether, given the hostage-taking situation here, whether one concession that the president can get is that, again, on the timing, that any austerity is pushed off a little bit so that it doesn't damage the next couple of years of recovery. But yeah, I mean, they've got the Democrats over a barrel because they're crazier than the Democrats, and they're willing to put the entire economy at risk for the sake of their agenda, which is not an agenda that is popularly supported, although I don't think they realize that.
Well, I imagine it is the Norquist Koch agenda, but the long and the short of it is anybody on the Democratic Party pointing this out when you talk about facts and truth? My understanding of the $14 trillion national debt, that two-thirds of it was run up by Bush Sr. and Jr. and Ronald Reagan. Sorry, half of it was run up by Bush Sr., Ronald Reagan, and fully one-third of it was run up by George W. Bush alone in the entire history of the Republic.
Right. That's absolutely true that they make it like the debt was all run up under Obama. And in fact, his contribution is very, very small, even though some of it is built up under his time. Most of that is because of the continuation of the Bush tax cuts plus the recession. Whereas I think there's a much greater crime in that George Bush turned us from a period of surplus handed to him by President Clinton and turned us into deficits when we didn't need to have deficits, when the economy was doing reasonably well. And those deficits, there's really no excuse for. The deficits we have now are really necessary and appropriate to help us get out of the recession and to help get the economy moving. So you're right. It is a misperception if people think that President Obama has been sort of overseen or been responsible for most of the federal debt.
Well, I only hope that somebody points this out. Maybe we're living in a fact-free zone nowadays, and the truth doesn't matter, but I think it would at least be worth pointing out, given that the whole country is being held hostage over a so-called debt crisis, when it's the Republicans and just three Republican presidents responsible for running up over half of the entire debt in the history of this country.
Well, you have your radio show. Hopefully that'll help. We have our website, and there's lots of places to find this information.
I thank you for joining us, Michael Ettinger.
Been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Ettinger, who is Vice President for Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress. Prior to joining the Center, he spent 6 years as Economic Policy Institute, directing the Economic Analysis and Research Network. And before that, he was Tax Policy Director for Citizens for Tax Justice and the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a Pulitzer Prize winning writer who's written about a triple agent who struck one of the worst blows against the CIA. He wants a young
American. Do you remember your President Nixon? Do you remember the bills you have to pay? My falsity had stung me like a hornet. The poison sank and it paralyzed my will. I could not move to warn all the younger soldiers that they had been deserted from above.
Joining us now is Joby Warrick, who is the author of the new book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA. He covers national security for The Washington Post, where he's been a reporter since 1996. He won the Pulitzer Prize for a series called Boss Hogs, which documented the political environmental fallout caused by factory farming in the Southeast. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joby Warrick.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
And your story comes from the December 2009 incident at Khost, the base near the Pakistan-Afghan border. I believe it was originally a Soviet base, then it was a Special Forces base. But I remember when it happened, I thought, my God, there's got to be a story here. How did this happen? And you've done that in this brand new book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. Let's just go back, I guess, to how he was recruited by the Jordanian Mukhabarat. In your book, you mention, Joby Warrick, how when his father, Halil al-Balawi's was told of his son's death, he said that when he was at the beginning of 2009, when he was arrested and detained for 3 days by the Mukhabarat, then he was released, and there was clearly a severe change came over him. It is this, he wrote, that caused me to lose my son. What happened in those 3 days?
It's a remarkable beginning, of this incredible journey that starts really with a man who's a pediatrician. He's a father with two kids living in Amman, Jordan, which is a relatively modern Arab city. And he ends up being, the most unlikely spy, really, that you could possibly imagine. But here's a guy who has a dangerous habit on the side. He's living a quiet life superficially, but he's writing these terrible internet blogs, railing against the West, railing against Israel, inciting young Muslims to violence. But the Jordanians figure out who he is, and they arrest him, they interrogate him, they put him in this prison for 3 days, and don't exactly brutalize him, but just make very clear to him that his life's going to change forever, and he has to straighten up and become one of them, or else there's going to be all kinds of trouble. And here's the guy, he wasn't a terrorist, he wasn't some hardened criminal, and he actually flipped pretty quickly, and after, just a couple of days in their clutches, decides, sure, okay, I'm going to renounce my past, I'm going to be your guy from now on. That's how it all begins.
But surely, given the history of the father, given that the father came out of Palestine in the partition, lost everything, and the son grew up one of what 10 children in a refugee camp. I mean, my understanding is that the those places are kind of petri dishes for festering hatred, particularly of Israel and the West.
Yes, it's sort of a family hobby, I think, to sit around, you know, the family dinner table and talk about their bad luck and about the horrible things that have happened to them as a, just not only as a family, but as a group. And this young man, Humam, grew up in this environment, and they ended up being sort of kicked out not only from what is now Israel, but they moved briefly to Kuwait and got kicked out of that place after the first Iraq invasion. And so they've had all this hard luck. It's a sort of angry household, and all these feelings are transferred to a very angry young man, and not a stupid man, but one who's very bright, who understands the West, and has a lot of hostility toward us.
And he marries a Turkish wife, who's a journalist for a conservative Istanbul newspaper, who later translated a biography of Osama bin Laden into Turkish. What was her role in the radicalization? Although, you know, again, we don't. I suppose we have to assume in retrospect that when the Muhabarat flipped him, they didn't really flip him.
No, although at the time there were all appearances that he had gone the other way. But yeah, he had a pretty interesting partner in his wife, who was at least as ideological and at least as angry as he was for different reasons. And as you mentioned, she was very much into the Osama bin Laden story. The book that she translated from Arabic into Turkish was Osama bin Laden, the Che Guevara of the East. So she sort of lionized this guy, and he was a hero to her. And it's just an indication of how the couple felt when they had children. Their first daughter was named after a Palestinian hijacker. Then they had a second child, and they named her after a documentary filmmaker who made a film about the hijacker. So just a little flavor of how they, you know, what they talked about in their house.
Again, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Joby Warrick, author of the new book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. Now, the case officer, who is a cousin of Jordan's king, Ali bin Zayed?
Zayed.
My understanding is, though, that the Muhabarat have always pretty much been subsidized by the CIA. So was this a little bit of what shall I say, irrational exuberance, to quote Alan Greenspan, on their part? Were they so anxious to find a way to curry favor with the CIA? What do you ascribe their eagerness to offer this guy up as a double agent?
Yeah, you're right about the relationship. It's very close. The United States gives the Jordanian government a lot of money, and many people will say that the Jordanian intelligence agency is owned by the CIA. It's a little more complicated than that. They're actually quite good in their own right. We use them, we rely on them all the time, because the Jordanians are quite good at human intelligence, at running agents and informants, and that's something that the CIA has historically not been so good at. So we use them in all kinds of places in the world, and it's sometimes a relationship that has to be hidden or seldom discussed for political reasons, because it's not very popular in Jordan to say that we're kind of, they're lackeys of the U.S., but they do quite a bit of work for us. And they would like to, you know, to have us, have the CIA believe that they're quite effective. And so when they find someone like this, they find someone who's potentially of use to the United States, they're very happy to hold him up and say, look, here's what we've done for you. And, you know, you can take over this case now. It's what happened here. The Jordanian said to the CIA, we've recruited this guy, now he's yours. And the CIA handled him in Pakistan, and from the moment he arrived, he was essentially a CIA informant.
So how did he establish his bona fides with the CIA? My understanding from your book, Joby Warrick, the triple agent, the Al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA, is that he was able to work with Al-Qaeda, in effect, to fabricate a video, which then convinced the CIA that this Jordanian had penetrated Al-Qaeda.
And that's really an extraordinary reflection on the man himself, because here's someone, if you think about him, has no training as an agent of any kind, and he doesn't even speak the local language. He speaks Arabic and English. He gets dropped into Pashtun country in the tribal area of Pakistan, and sort of sink or swim. You know, find your own contacts, you know, try to do what you can, but without much help. And everybody looking at this man when he arrives, he's a Jordanian. That makes him suspect initially. Just sort of an odd character to be walking around this very remote area. And there was every expectation the guy would probably be seen as a spy and maybe executed. But instead, he's able to convince the Taliban initially, and later on Al-Qaeda itself, that he's on their side. So he's having to walk this line between these, you know, two very, very different worlds, and managed to convince both of them that he was legitimate.
So he, and of course he's in Haqqani territory there, right? In coast, which is on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And one of the things that I learned from your book, Joby Warwick, is that after the U.S. invasion following 9/11, when essentially the special forces entered coast. And took it over, and then they had a few skirmishes with the local tribesmen. There was a period there, even though Haqqani had helped bin Laden escape, he still was offering up his services because he'd worked for the CIA against the Soviets. And I take it that that many people think that the U.S. dropped the ball there, because we keep blaming the Pakistanis. We keep leaning on the Pakistanis who protect Haqqani. But we could have had him, right?
Haqqani is a warlord. He's out for Haqqani. And he runs that portion, or at least at the time, he ran that portion of Afghanistan by the border. And in fact, if you go to the city of Khost today, there's one really striking, beautiful building. It's this large mosque with this great turquoise dome. And this is Haqqani's mosque. He built it for the city. Essentially, this is his property, his tribesmen. And he was perfectly willing, according to both CIA and Pakistani sources, to go with the U.S. side. He wasn't really a Taliban sympathizer. He went along with them for a few years just because it sort of had to be done to do business over there. But our overture to him was, okay, we'll let you come on our side, but you have to put on an orange jumpsuit and go hang out at Guantanamo Bay for a while. And, of course, he wasn't willing to do that, and so he became our enemy, and he continues to fight and kill Americans till this day.
So Joby Warwick, again, the author of the new book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. So here we have this Jordanian operating ostensibly for the CIA, who have this base in a coast, a former Soviet base, then a special forces base. The woman that heads it up, Jennifer Matthews, has a young assistant, Elizabeth Hansen, and they're running this guy who, I guess, as soon as he meets with the Taliban, signs up with them, then he manages to convince the CIA that he's infiltrating Al-Qaeda. What are the role? I mean, he clearly had a connection here with Massoud, particularly the surviving one that took over after the CIA predator had killed Baitullah Massoud.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So walk us through that, because I want to build up, as the book does, to the moment where the suicide vest bomb, 30 pounds of C4 with hundreds and hundreds of pellets, explodes and kills seven CIA officers. But just before we get to that, I want to be able to set the groundwork as your book does.
Yeah, the Massouds are the leaders of the Taliban in Pakistan, and a man named Baitullah Massoud. If I can draw a portrait of him, he's a very short, stocky man, probably about 5'2", with this big, ragged black beard. Was sort of a gun runner, a smuggler. A thug, but he ends up becoming the commander of the Taliban in Pakistan. And this is the man that our triple agent, Humam Balawi, ends up taking up with, staying in his house, eating at his dinner table. Massoud instinctively trusts him, and so he asks him to, you know, come join us, come to our training camp, come live with us, and Balawi readily does that. Well, it turns out that the CIA is very interested in Massoud for a number of reasons, one of which they think he has a dirty bomb they'd like to blow up in a Western city. And so they're looking for this man, too, And in, as the book unfolds, they find him in August of 2009 and target him while he's getting his legs massaged by his wife on the roof of his house and hit him with a drone strike. And from that moment, all kinds of new elements are brought into this storyline, including the fact that the Taliban now, the Massoud clan, are just determined to get revenge on the CIA for killing this leader of theirs, and they see Balawi as potentially a way to do that.
But Balawi himself didn't tip off the Predators. My understanding is that they paid off the father-in-law, whose daughter, by the way, was killed, giving him the leg massage. Is that right?
Exactly, yes. So Balawi was sort of innocent in that particular episode. He didn't tip off the CIA to Massoud's presence. But later on, after this takes place, as he's beginning to demonstrate his bona fides to the CIA, he is involved in some of the targeting for drone strikes and helps the CIA do their sort of bomb damage assessment, determining who was killed and what kind of follow-up action they need to do.
So then, Joby Warwick, take us through now to the climax here, where you've got Jennifer Matthews, who worked under Michael Scheuer, who I've spoken to a number of times, and obviously she's dogged in her hunt for Al-Qaeda, and there's this possibility that the Jordanian is the key, and this young woman as well, Elizabeth Hansen. How much were they blinding themselves?
They were extremely interested in what this man had potentially to bring to them, and he promised, not only to help them with drone strikes, but he was going to be able to deliver Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two Al-Qaeda leader, and it had physical, incontrovertible evidence that he'd been in the presence of this man and other Al-Qaeda leaders. So when he comes to the CIA and says, "I can deliver these people to you," everyone takes it very seriously because he has proof on top of his claims. And so it becomes imperative for the CIA to set up a meeting with this guy because no one had ever met him. He was, one of the most exciting, electrifying agents in the CIA's employ, but no one had ever laid eyes on him. So it became extremely important to try to set up a meeting in a controlled environment so they could bring the guy in, look at him, check him out, and just see, is he really telling the truth, or is he bluffing? Is he a con artist? Whatever, we have to find this out. So much effort and planning is put into setting up this pivotal meeting when the CIA is going to confront this man for the first time.
Well, but the fact, if the Jordanians are the ones that are case officers, even though there was a CIA case officer assigned to him, I don't understand why, if he hadn't been totally vetted and if there were still doubts about him, why did they expose themselves in such a way that they all were killed?
As some of the agency officers who planned this meeting told me later, that it's like the 9/11 attack when, there's all kinds of warning flags that were raised that look obvious in hindsight. But for everyone at the time, the potential benefit of being able to capture or kill senior Al-Qaeda leaders was so alluring that all these other warnings were dismissed or downgraded or not emphasized. And they also, I think there had never been a case where an informant had lured CIA officers into a room and then blown himself up and killed himself. This had never happened before, so no one was looking for it. Instead, they were going out of the way to try to make this guy comfortable, to try to create a safe, secure environment for him, even baked him a cake because it had been his birthday a few days before that. All attention paid to making this guy feel very safe and protected when, in fact, he was intending to kill them the whole time.
Well, Joby Warwick, I thank you for joining us and for your new book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. We sort of barely scratched the surface of it. I just wanted to go through the story, which is told very dramatically, and it's a great read. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for your time.
Again, I've been speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Joby Warwick, the author of the new book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.